A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey everyone, welcome to the 281st episode of Just Shoot It, a podcast about filmmaking, screenwriting, and directing. This episode is brought to you by patrons Deanna Bechtel, Joe Harris, Cody Flores-Jaragui, and Josh Tanner. I'm Oren Kaplan.
And I'm Matt Enlow. Today we've got Corey Adelson on the show. She's a development executive over at Chernin Entertainment. She's the executive behind the smash hit Netflix trilogy, Fear Street. It's got a very interesting story of how she managed to manifest that project to life and to fruition. And I think it's a really good story of how things get made, basically, in the similar trajectory of what it takes for an executive to rise to the top and to actually get something made and how to champion something. So if you are curious about the way that development works, if you're curious about the way that things get made, if you're curious about the way that things get pitched or the politics of it, I think that Corey has a ton of interesting insight. She came up as an assistant. And so it's a very common story that we don't have on the show very frequently, which is really nice. So we kind of get into the game that is Hollywood. She's really fun. She's so funny. She's so passionate. I think it's a good reminder that in order to be a development executive, you have to love movies just as much as we love making them. It's just a different...
I'd say more.
Yeah, frankly, more. Yeah, you really do have to hustle pretty darn hard for a long time before you get anything good on the table.
Yeah, what I found interesting is, obviously, before we talked to Corey, I looked her up on IMDb, and she has these producing credits on Fear Street, these like big Netflix movies, and from her bio, I knew she'd been in the business for a long time. But, you know, in development, you don't get a lot of IMDb credits because you're just trying to get things made for years and years. And then when we talked to her, and she worked for Fox, she worked for Paramount, she's worked for all these crazy people working on these huge projects. It's just interesting to hear about that. Obviously, we are kind of exposed to it, you know, if we write a script and we're trying to sell it to someone or send it out or pitch a show or get reps. We're exposed to the agency world a little bit, but we really don't live on that side of Hollywood as filmmakers, you know, as freelancers, as independent, you know, artists, I guess, not to sound too artsy-fartsy about it. But it was really fun to talk to Corey. And I didn't even realize she was married to Paul Briganti, previous guest of the show. You gave me a hard time. You're like, I told you that 100 times.
That's
I know
true,
a lot of Pauls, okay?
Yeah, but only one of them do I call Briganti. So that's okay. That's okay. You had a lot on your plate lately. No big deal.
Well, yeah. Well, speaking of having a lot on our plates, I just wanted to talk real quickly about time management. I know it's something we've touched probably on the podcast a while ago, definitely pre-COVID, but I'm running into kind of crazy time management issues. Literally, as we speak, I have a baby strapped to my chest. I'm holding a pacifier in his mouth, just praying he doesn't start screaming. My wife is at work. My in-laws took my daughter to swimming practice. We just came back from COVID tests for the first day of kindergarten. You know, I have 5 edits due tonight. I have family things going on this weekend. And then I'm starting a new job, commercial job, on Monday, while also continuing an existing commercial job. Luckily, everything I have coming up is in LA, so I don't have to fly anywhere. But how do you just, like, even scheduling the meetings? And this other job that I'm finishing up is an East Coast company. So, like, my calendar is just, it looks wide open on Monday. And then by the time I get to Wednesday, it's like I'm squeezing in 15-minute things at a time.
Yeah.
Trying to record a podcast, trying to do all these things. And then at the same time, you still need to like get inspired and read the news and socialize, have meals, which is the hardest thing to do.
Yeah, be a parent, all of that stuff. Yeah, it's tricky because
what's the secret?
I think that there is if you have too much time on your hands, if you're unemployed, essentially, and you're feeling listless or defeated in some way, I find that really, really hard. It's very hard for me to be productive when I have nothing going on. And if I am overextended, obviously, that's really hard as well. I'm kind of in a sweet spot right now where I'm on one challenging, fruitful, decently paying job. And so I'm still, my personal projects are lagging behind because of it. But I'm active, I'm thinking, I'm engaged, I'm going the extra mile on that one project. But a few weeks ago, I was on two, and you do feel the stress of it pretty quickly.
Yeah, plus the life stuff. It's the life stuff, and I think we live in an industry, and I've noticed this social movement recently. I don't know if you've been seeing it on Instagram and stuff, people talking about protections from being overworked, like working 16-hour days on set and being expected to be on set like 6 hours later. There's this culture where we work, especially as freelancers, of you just cannot say no to a job. You know, say yes to every job and figure out how to stack them on top of each other, you know, if you get them, because so many times you're offered a job and it doesn't happen, or you're offered a job and it pushes to next year, you know, or things fall apart. So do you have some sort of litmus test to decide whether you take a job that you're offered, or what more often than not happens is we're not offered jobs to have. It's not like, hey, Matt, will you work on this? It's more like, hey, Matt, I have an opportunity for you.
Yeah, will you pitch on this? Yeah.
Will you spend 3 days on this job that you might not get?
Unfortunately, my litmus test, I think, is the same as yours, and it's a bad one, is am I technically free that day? Am I shooting on the days that they want to shoot or not? And that's most of it. Tech scout, auditions, there's a few things that you can kind of move around. And I'm always upfront with a producer when those jobs come up. That's kind of the main thing, to be honest. And that's a bad way of managing your time. But I'm with you, man. I think it's a thing where...
Well, let me give you a hypothetical scenario. And we can move on, because I know this is a problem without a solution. But let's say next Tuesday you are shooting a short film. You got this actor that is only available this one day, and you've been dying to work with them, and you think your whole short is based on them. You're shooting that on Tuesday. You have in LA. On Thursday, you have a commercial in Dallas, and on Saturday, you have a wedding in Seattle. Do you just make all of those things work, or do you try to pull out of something?
Yeah, I try to make all of those things work. But certainly, I think once you're committed with a personal project, when you have a shoot day, you have to treat that like any other job. I think a better question is, you're going to shoot a short in 2 weeks. You've been trying to get this actor. They're locked in, they're ready to go, and then a paying job comes up. That's a harder question. And I think you still have to go.
And a paying job with a company that you've been wanting to work with, and this is the first time they've actually come.
That's a heck of a lot harder, and it depends on what the payday is also. Like, you know, there's a handful of paid jobs where you're like, okay, well, I can afford to not take that. And then there are ones where you can't afford to turn them down. And I think that's a harder problem. The last thing I want to say about this, though, because I think it's going to be different for each person. And I think of Kara Durrett, who was on the show recently, talking about how, you know, the question of how much money do you actually need is valid and important. And I think it's a little different when you've got kids or a mortgage or you're freelance and, you know, you're less certain of where your next paycheck is coming from. But that question is still important. But the other thing to think about, Oren, and we talk about this all the time on the show, is those personal projects are the reasons that you level up. They're the reasons that you upgrade. They're the reasons that you're in it in the first place, right? And so if you don't dedicate the time to your screenplay or your short or your spec or your proof of concept, those are the things that where you're paying yourself. Those are the passion projects that will lead to bigger and better things. And if you skip out on those investments early on or ever, you know, then eventually it's going to catch up to you. And I feel like over the last few years, I've been reminded of that. And I would say that lately, now that things are busy again, I have to be reminded of it, because I spent the pandemic doing a good job of really investing my time in personal projects that I think will really generate bigger results for my career. And now that I'm getting paid to do other things, it's a heck of a lot easier to not follow up in an email or not hustle as hard as I should be, you know? And that's the real question, is how do you figure out how to push that stuff forward? And that's frankly something that Corey Adelson in this episode talks a lot about, that you have to spend 10% of your working time investing in Corey Adelson entertainment, right?
Yeah.
And
and that would be an excellent segue into our interview if I didn't have one more thing to add, which is that, yes, of course, it's nice to get paid to direct. And that's kind of the dream job that we more or less have. But the thing is, for me, it's not about, I want to take this job because it's a big payday and I'm going to turn down this job because it's a small, low budget thing. To me, the big payday only serves to overcome a job I'm not interested in. Like if a job paid nothing, but I think the creative is cool, or cool talent, or cool location, cool something, I'm usually in. To me, it's a fear I kind of learned from, like, when I first moved to LA, like 15 years ago. It's the idea that if I say no to someone, they won't come back to me. And it's a way that a lot of people in Hollywood prey on new filmmakers and new workers, and that, hey, you know, we can't pay you for this, but come shoot this concert and edit this thing together.
Are you ready for...
I have this bigger job coming
up. Are you ready for the horrible truth, Oren?
Yes.
Even if you say yes, they might not come back to you.
Right. But one of those gives you an opportunity to do a good job, and the other one is a hope... A hope that somebody else that they take doesn't do a good job, you know?
Yeah, fair enough. But you hear my point, right? Like, that you don't really have a ton of control. And like, if they wanted to work with you in the first place, it's because the work that you've done thus far is of a high enough quality that they're interested in working with you, right?
Yeah, or I happen to have the right thing on my reel for the project they're doing, or I know a person. But I mean, they do say that kind of success is when talent meets opportunity, right?
Sure.
Is that a thing that people say?
I think that is a thing that people say.
And so you can't show people the talent without the opportunity. And so it's hard to turn opportunities down, even if they don't pay well or they're hard to fit into the schedule.
Yeah. I think you're right about both of us, I think, put creative first relative to paydays. So that is a valid and tricky question, Oren. But, you know, there's no good answer to it. So...
Yeah. Well, if you want to hire me for the rest of August, I am unavailable.
And if you would like to hire me for the last week of August, you know, hit me up. Sounds good.
Yeah. August 27th, I'm available. Oh, it's my mom's birthday.
Hey,
that's the thing.
Hey, happy birthday.
As you get older, it's not that there's so much more work. It's just there's so many other non-work.
You have things. So much more life. Yeah, sure. There's stuff to do. Yeah.
Anyhow, let us know how you guys do it. What's your strategy for saying yes and no to jobs if you're listening to this, especially if you're a freelancer and you have various opportunities at different various levels that satisfy various needs in your life and how you juggle it all? We'd love to hear. We're justshootitpod@gmail.com.
Yeah, let us know. Before we hop into our conversation with Corey, Oren, did you know that we have a Patreon?
Yeah, I literally send the names of the patrons that sponsor, that patronized this episode.
I guess this is a pretty hacky transition.
Deanna, Joe, Cody, and Josh.
Listen, man, it's pretty hot in my apartment. I'm doing the best I can. Patreon.com/justshootitpod is a place where you can go to support the show a little bit. Support our editor, Sarah. Shout out to Sarah. She's still at it, cutting away this show, making it better every single episode. And we really appreciate it. We've been making some upgrades to the show that hopefully you've noticed by now. Our ads are a little cleaner. Things are a little bit better. And so all of that is thanks to you and your support on Patreon.com. If you want to show the world how much you love the show, go ahead and spend $10. Then we'll send you a hat, just like Oren does from his very apartment where he is, or his home, where he is currently bouncing his baby and recording this episode. So
it's more of a rock.
Yeah, sure.
Than a bounce.
All right. Well, without further ado, we will hop into perhaps an ad or two and then our conversation with Corey.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Cool. Well, thanks for coming on our show. Congrats on Fear Street.
Thank you so much.
Way to scare America.
Yeah.
And
three times. You scared us thrice.
So you're a producer, right? Can you tell us a little bit about how you got into producing and your background?
Sure. I studied theater in college. I always loved storytelling. I grew up on film. I grew up in LA, so it was kind of a part of my DNA, and maybe the only thing I thought people were possible that it was possible to do. Like that it was a kind of the opposite scenario of many people being like, I never thought I could work in film. Like I only knew that that was what was possible.
That was the only job anybody
had. Yeah.
You're like, yeah, but you're not a real accountant, right? That's like a role you're playing.
Yeah, exactly. I was like, but there's only producing. I don't know what else is there.
Were your parents in entertainment?
Yeah, they were. My mother was a producer. My father was a producer. My uncle, my grandpa. I have a very long lineage in my family of producers. And I deeply didn't want to follow their path. And I was like, fuck you guys. I want nothing to do with any of you. And then I went to college and I came home and I was an intern at Paramount Vantage and I was reading all these incredible scripts and they had such amazing taste and amazing ambitions there. And I was reading all the stuff that I loved and I came home and I said to my parents, this is the most incredible thing I've ever experienced. They go, that's producing. You're fucked. You're totally fucked.
That's so funny.
All this time that you've been trying to rebel,
yeah,
it's not going to work. It's destiny. But I just fell in love, and I've always loved film. I've always loved movies, and I saw movies alone by myself in theaters for my entire life, and then came back to it through this internship, and then started to I worked at Paramount.
Wait, is Paramount Vantage, that wasn't the $100,000 scary movie one?
No. Yeah, it's like they have amazing taste.
Right. What
amazing.
Was that one I'm thinking
they made
of?
17 Paranormals.
Yeah. What was that called? I'm trying to remember now.
Yeah. I know what you're talking about, but I don't know. It was the subsidiary of the studio that made the most expensive indie art films that have ever been made in the history of Hollywood. And it was kind of a charmed place that just made really cool shit. And then Adam Goodman, who was the president of Paramount, he basically came in while I was an intern at that place and shuttered it. So while I was an intern, I was like moving out their boxes and being like, Hollywood seems awesome. It seems really cool here.
Yeah.
It seems like you guys get to make really amazing things.
It's like you guys have a new boss every 7 years though. This is crazy.
Really disheartening way to come into the industry. But he was sort of the proponent of the paranormal movies and the Justin Bieber era of paramount.
Like he wanted to make money instead of art, more than art, maybe.
Yeah. Yeah. He was like, oh, you guys are making $100 million art films. That's interesting. Mm-hmm. I would like to make the Bieber film that is going to make $200 million and is produced for five. And so that was a sort of depressing reality. And then, so I worked there and then kind of that started my intent and passion to work against that idea as much as humanly possible. So I worked at Paramount for a couple of years and then I went to go work at Universal for the president of production there. I worked for him for about 2 years. And then...
And when you say you worked for him, you were like his assistant, like on his desk or...
Yeah. Yeah. I was his second assistant and I was his second assistant for 2 years, a year, basically a year into it, I told him I need to go work for someone who's going to promote me. Like I need to go work for, be someone's first assistant because how am I ever going to get, like, I need to keep moving. And he goes, who will you ever work for that's better than me? And he said, what are you talking about? Just stay with me for
so
one
funny.
More year.
That's what I say to every crew member I've ever
Yeah. Wait, but unfortunately, like worked.
But Corey, I'm curious, believe it or not, this is episode 281. We have, even though it's such a common story that people came up by working at desk at, you know, CAA or whatever, or the mailroom, that whole story, the Tarantino version, we actually haven't had a ton of people that came up that way. Can you tell us, like, for someone that just graduated film school and wants to be a producer or however they want to be a producer, how do you get an assistant job like that? How do you become a second assistant to the president of Paramount?
Mm-hmm. And a follow-up question, the difference between a second and first assistant.
Sure, but I can answer both questions. When I was at Paramount, what I learned was that it was a really relationship-based business. And so I was working for two junior executives there, and every single assistant that I emailed with at agencies, at studios, at wherever, I would always, you know, anyone who had the even slightest interest of hanging out with me, I would try to hang out. I would try to get drinks or try to get lunch or try to connect with them somehow so I could start to build friendships and relationships with people that I had respect for, that I felt had similar taste to me or had similar ambition to me, that I felt we were a part of the same school of thought. And
can I ask you, sorry to interrupt, but like a real dumb question. And I know, I think I know the answer to this, but I'd love to hear it from your perspective. Do you just email like another assistant and say, hey, do you want to go get a drink? And is there like any...
Corey's nodding yes.
Is there tension?
It is a common thread of like, that Or and I both are like, wait, how do you actually make friends with people in Hollywood?
No, but is there a tension if it's like a male assistant that asks you out, like, you know, how do you navigate dating versus getting drinks versus networking and all that
unbelievably
stuff?
Unbelievably complicated. And I was so happy when, like, I met Paul and that was like not a part of the equation anymore. That was a really, it helped not being so complicated. But no, it's really like, I think when you're working for someone, you're in the trenches together and you're like, you're all trying to make shit happen and trying to both appease your bosses and also like follow protocol and, and politic about who sort of, like, there's kind of a very set hierarchy of scheduling in the assistant game where it's like, okay, if you're a studio assistant, the producers need to sort of, you give them the times and then they must agree to your times. And it's the politic of the assistant game. Mm-hmm. And if you don't understand that, it becomes complicated. And so you're in this thing with these people trying to be like, my boss wants to set for tomorrow. Your boss wants to set this for a week from now. How do we figure this out? So it ends up kind of being like, you get a sense of people's personalities in that process. And yeah, it's like you basically if anyone shows an iota of personality or mm-hmm. or eagerness to connect, you're kind of like, oh, you're my people. And you say, like, can we get drinks after work? Like, I would love to mm-hmm. talk to you. And it's also a way of bringing information into your boss that's valuable to them.
It's part of the job, right?
It's totally like part of the job.
Oh, just one last dumb question, and then we'll get to the good questions. When I know you're years beyond that, but are there places where like assistants go to get drinks? Is there like,
I remember at Trader Vic's used to be a thing. Do you know, it's not there anymore, but I remember just like, because my in-laws love Trader Vic's, and every once in a while you just see like a swarm of like 23-year-old assistants just like getting hammered on tiki drinks in Beverly Hills.
Yeah, you get so drunk. That's like the only way, to kind of like make friends is just you get so drunk together and just, you know, talk about how terrible your bosses are and how shitty the circumstances are and how all of that stuff. I don't really remember, actually. It's just so long ago. I think it was like, I remember going to Fairfax a lot. I remember going to Fairfax a lot and like La Brea a lot somehow, but no, you would, it's like it's a trading of information, and information mm-hmm. is collateral, and it's very valuable to your bosses because assistants will tell you things and you'll share information with assistants in a way that executives are too guarded to do and can't do really, because mm-hmm. you guys, like the relationship building and the trust building comes from being like, okay, I need this for my boss wants me to do this impossible thing. And I don't know how to, like, there is no other way to get it done than to have friends. Mm-hmm. They're just, you know, you have to sort of, it's a trade-off. You have to say, I have this information. If I trust you with this and you won't burn me, then, and I won't burn you, then you tell me like how the new Mission Impossible ends. And also you, you know, it's like, it's sort of like that. My, when I went to go work at Universal for Peter Kramer, the first thing he asked me, and I love him, he's just a mentor and the best person I've ever worked for, and just a wonderful, wonderful person. But he, the first day on the job, he said, because I worked on Mission Impossible at Paramount with my bosses were on the movies, and he goes, tell me how it ends. I need to know if it's anything like these five movies that I'm working on. And I had just left them, and I was so loyal to them, and I was so loyal to the studio, and I love that studio so much. And I was like completely panicked. And then it was this moment of just being like, okay, I work for you now.
Sure.
You know, my loyalty lies with you now. It's over now.
I gotta admit, I'm kind of shocked that someone would care like how a Mission Impossible ends.
But think about it. If your movie ends with like a crazy helicopter set piece, that would be a problem if you're spending hundreds of millions of dollars.
But by that point, by the time people get to the ending, they've already paid for the movie.
Well, the relevance to him, was, how does that Mission Impossible movie end? Because we are developing these three like big caper movies that end in a, like, let's say a big helicopter set piece. And I want to know if that movie has a big helicopter sequence so we don't look stupid. Mm-hmm. And like, it's, you know, it's, we're coming out after them, and I want context to have an understanding of the marketplace at large and have an understanding of how that's going to impact our future releases. So like, information is everything, and that's like, information is power, basically.
Yeah.
So that's sort of,
Corey,
what it is.
You said something that I want to highlight. You said they don't want to look stupid, right? And that's really, that's the whole thing. Or and you're like, what's the big deal? Like, box office is box office. It doesn't matter if you look stupid. That's the other currency, right? That's the other collateral.
100%. I work for Peter Chernin, and Peter always says, like, I've asked him many times what is the source of his drive and his ambition and what makes him keep doing the thing. And he said, I just really don't want to be embarrassed. He said, that's really about it. And he's so prolific, and he's such a like brilliant guy. And he, that's it. He's just like, I don't want to be embarrassed. That's it.
Yeah, I love it. One other thing that I think is worth pointing out, because like Oren said, we haven't had a ton of people who came up as assistants on the show. What I love about your story and what it clarified for me is like, you there, even though it wasn't maybe written down anywhere or necessarily prescriptive, there was a clear hierarchy. You are learning the social rules of Hollywood. And I kind of came in sideways and was working at Comedy Central for a long time, but didn't ever get that opportunity to observe. And I just constantly felt like everyone's speaking another language. And I don't know, it felt like my fly was down for 5 years.
You know what I mean? Totally. The first time someone says like left word, you're like, what the fuck
like,
does
what
that
are you
mean?
Talking
I don't
about?
Even, yeah. You're like, I don't know. There's like, there's such a lingo and a language mm-hmm. to the industry, or like, I didn't know the difference between a spec script or mm-hmm. a sample or mm-hmm. a, you know, you had to like you learn, you, there's no way to know any of this stuff. Like it is not taught. It is completely observed. Mm-hmm. And it is like, it is really school. Like that's what it feels mm-hmm. like. It feels like you're going through school and then.
And you internalize.
What's that term for calling a bunch of people back?
Rolling calls.
Yeah. Like where you have a list of people you got to get. Yeah.
Yeah. It's like putting it on the phone sheet. We're going to roll calls. And then you like call your assistant and you go roll calls on the phone sheet. And
is that still a thing though? Like do people still roll calls? That's fun.
I wrote calls today.
You were driving on your way to set over the hill.
Even worse, I was in my house being like, let's roll calls.
I'm curious, Corey, actually, since you started, which was, you know, a little while ago, has the business shifted to be more email based than call based, or is a big deal, like an important transaction, still going to happen on a phone call? Like, is it a bigger deal if an agent or a manager calls you than if they email you?
I think it's both personal style and strategy based. For example, I find that calling people, you get a more like personal interaction with people and you get to express passion in a different way. But then there's also times where there's a more effective communication by just being sort of succinct and direct without giving the opportunity for back and forth. So mm-hmm. it's like, it really depends what your agenda is and what your objective is.
But also, isn't there like people under the age of 30 don't talk on the phone? Like if there's a hot new writer or director or someone.
No, I actually, you know, oddly, I haven't found that it's changed that much. I find that like people prefer emailing usually because it's faster, it's more efficient. Mm-hmm. You know, when you call someone, you can end up being on the phone with them for 15 minutes because there's like the obligatory mm-hmm. like bullshitting in the beginning of a conversation that has to happen it doesn't feel so impersonal. So it is a faster form of communication, but I always find that a phone call does the job better. So I'm more and it's, to me, it's a better indication of your passion and your personality and all of those mm-hmm. things, and it's a great way to get to know people. So I call mostly and then I email when it makes sense, and it's so weird because there really is no guidebook to the job. You really mm-hmm. kind of figure it out as you go along what works for you. But to answer your question about going from Paramount to Universal and how I got that job, it's a weird thing because they tell you in the beginning of the like, you ask people how to get jobs because it feels so it feels intangible because there is no
there's no help wanted sign on the wall of Paramount.
So you like, you don't know where to find those really cool jobs. It's like, it's nearly impossible. So that's sort of where the relationship building comes in your assistanting jobs. And then also I found a really effective way, and part of the way that I got the job at Universal was I used to go on deadline every day and I would look at who had gotten a new deal somewhere, who had just gotten promoted, who had moved jobs. Like that stuff was all reported. So you can assume that if someone is moving a job, you could be like, okay, are they going to take their assistant with them? Maybe they won't. If they don't, they're probably going to need one. Who do I know at this company? Who do I know that knows someone at this company? How do I get through to them in a way that's personal and not a part of like a bigger batch of.
You're not just jumping on LinkedIn is what you're saying.
No, yeah. it's like you need to kind of be very strategic about how your resume gets on the desk of someone important, because they don't have a lot of time and there's a lot of incoming interest, and you kind of want to, it needs to somehow rise to the top. So in the process, I mean, before I worked at Paramount, I was working like in between my internship and coming back to Paramount, I worked at an agency called Innovative Artists. And I was there for about 6 months before I went to Paramount. But that was like, that was my first job. And it was sort of like a job begets a job. Just take a job, just take a job, whatever job you get. They were like, you'll make $2,000 a year. And I was like, yeah.
Wait, at Innovative Artists, they mainly represent actors, right?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And I had no interest in doing that at all. But I kind of like, it's sort of like whatever entry point into the industry you can get, it's all very related. And it's all very, from an assistant level, you're still sort of
in like, the network.
Even if you're, if you're working for a talent agent, you're still reading all of the material that comes in through their desk and starting to get to know writers and get to know names and all of that stuff.
I'm actually curious about that, because you've been on both sides probably of attaching talent and, you know, being on the talent side, trying to get people attached to their projects. What you were talking about, how to get your resume to the top of the list or how to have a personal connection. What are some things you've seen that have maybe newer filmmakers have done successfully to attach talent to their projects? Are there any like tips or things that you shouldn't do?
No, I think attaching talent is it all depends again, like what the alchemy of pieces that are together when you're going out to a piece of talent. But I always find that a letter to a piece of talent sort of explaining that kind of outlines your passion for the material, your passion for this piece of talent, and why you believe them to be the perfect person for your film.
A love letter. Yeah.
A love letter. Everyone loves to be loved. Like that's universal. So I think that's always impactful.
And you're saying that like it's so obvious, but Matt, how many times have we heard new filmmakers think that the missing key to getting their movie made is to get a casting director that will help them
director, attach. A casting director will tell you to write a love letter at the very least.
Yeah, no, it's so not it. It depends what level of talent you're going for. It depends what the context is. But if you're going for a like major piece of talent, it's the age-old moniker of relationships. It's like who on their team do you know that's gonna receive your call and take it seriously? You know, who, or if you don't know those people, how do you get your boss to make a call on your behalf? You know, how do you convince them that it's not gonna make them look stupid to advocate for you or your project or whatever it is, and force them to make whatever calls you need them to make. Yeah.
But what I'm hearing though that I think is really valuable is like it's still about the connect, right? It's not going to work as a cold situation.
It's not
right?
about like, the material.
It is about the material. It's material is always like
it has to be there plus the connect.
Yeah.
It has to be there, but it's also, look, this is what I will say. A good script is always a good script. You know, it doesn't matter who it comes in from. A good piece of material is a good piece of material. But what I will say is that what I've found is that executives are busy as fuck, and they're like, they are drowning under material. They are drowning under their workload, and whatever you can do to cut through the noise and try and make something urgent for people is always impactful.
You said, what are they going to take seriously, right? So they only have time for the things that they can take seriously, and the stuff that like they maybe really want, they have to. That's the only stuff that there's enough hours in the day for.
Yeah, I mean, it depends who you are, but I think that's the you want to make it urgent. So mm-hmm. as a producer representing directors, you know, or being a representative on their behalf, you always try to make sure that you're positioning a project in a way that makes it impossible for them to ignore. So whether that's how you build it in advance of sending it out to people, or how you develop the material, or how you put it together in advance of sending it to that talent, that's always important. But it's also how you position it. Like you have mm-hmm. to, there's a huge strategy that goes into approaching each conversation about each project, in the sense that you're kind of figuring out what each place wants mm-hmm. in advance of that, which executive loves these kinds of projects, which mm-hmm. executive is new to the company, so doesn't have a lot of projects and needs to impress their boss. So you know, like they're mm-hmm. they're desperate for material, and they've called their agent, this, you know, the agency 100 times to say, I really want a romantic comedy, or like, I need a Christmas movie, or whatever it is. Like, you kind of have to do your homework to figure out who the players are, what they want, what they're looking for, what their needs are, what their, you know, mm-hmm. Insecurities are, all that stuff before you kind of walk in the door. Usually.
Go for it. Right. And just to clarify, when you say urgency, you do not mean putting a 24-hour deadline on an offer.
No. But no, just make, I mean, sometimes it's that too, right? It's like, sometimes it's being like when I first started, for example, on using Fear Street as an example, when I first optioned that material, and we'll get to that probably, but
let's actually, no, because I think that Fear Street is a perfect lens to illustrate all of the things that you're talking about, right? So let's start at the beginning. I think there's kind of a novel story to this, right? But so Fear Street is kind of like a beloved like anthology series, right? From the like 90s, basically. It was like R.L. Stein, you know, he had Goosebumps and he had Fear Street. And it was like, if you were a little older, a little edgier, Fear Street was your shit. And if you were like in elementary school, you're like, oh, Goosebumps is pretty hardcore. So I'm good with that.
And so, Goosebumps had been made into a movie franchise already.
Yes. Yeah. So take us back to the time before Fear Street was even optioned, let's say. How about that? Let's start at the beginning there.
Okay. I was a junior executive at Chernin, which was my first job as an executive. And there were 7 senior executives at my company, about roughly. And my old boss, Peter Kramer, gave me some of the best advice I had ever been given, which was, the work never ends. You will be working, you can be reactive for your entire life as an executive. So 90% of the time you're working for Chernin Entertainment, and 10% of the time you're working for Corey Adelson Entertainment. So like, spend an hour a day, every day, being proactive toward the goals that you want to achieve. So what I realized really quickly is, after a year of sort of gaining the confidence of my colleagues and my coworkers, and working to support them and working to make sure that, and learning so much from them and gaining the tools to become my own advocate, I realized pretty quickly that no one is going to send you material, because I am the youngest person at the company. There's 7 other people who are way more experienced than I am, who have way deeper relationships than I do. And no one is going to call you and be like, hey, I have a package with Leonardo DiCaprio and James Mangold. Do you want to produce this? Like, it's just not, that's not what happened. It just doesn't happen. So,
but do you not get, I mean, obviously, you know, like a Paul Briganti, you know, these directors that are doing shorts, that are doing commercials, that are doing cool viral videos, that probably have scripts that are kind of up and coming. Are your friends, like your other assistant friends, not saying like, you're at Chernin, you know, I'm going to send you my script?
Yeah, I did. Like, I made, what you're doing as a junior executive is you're meeting absolutely everyone you can. You're building relationships with up and coming talent that hopefully, as you grow and as they grow, those will be really enduring relationships that will continue to feed the business. But when I came up, my company's deal was at Fox, and mm-hmm. the kind of movies that they were making and the kind of movies that they were making them with were And the kind of movies we were making at the time were, it was not possible. You know, it wasn't, it didn't seem possible to just find a script and run with it and be like, okay, because my company didn't, we were such a big company. And
because you had to have Leonardo DiCaprio and James Mangold. That was the only stuff you were making.
The only way you were going to get something made is that whether there had to be one element of the equation that was undeniable. So,
but are you not the person, sorry to interrupt, but are you not the person that a manager at Anonymous Content or something just signed a Sundance director and they have a feature script and they had a premiere? Are you not the person that they send to meet at the company?
Always. So I would meet those people and we would fall in love and we would say, like, what can we do together? And now that I'm more senior in my job, now that's the time where I can do that, right? So it's like, but back then I was working within a system where 10 movies were made a year and they were all IP based and they were all huge directors or huge pieces of tech. There had to be some reason why the studio was forced to make it, you know? And if there's always a success story, and I feel that Fear Street ended up becoming that, but it was, but it's hard. It's really hard because you have to find something also that your bosses are going to care about and take seriously. So you're like, you're contemplating all of those things at the same time. And you're figuring out how do I push something through this impossible system?
Is 10 still the number today, even with the Netflixes and the Hulus? And
no, now in Netflix, we moved our deal over to Netflix about a year and a half ago or 2 years ago, and they make 72 movies a year. They're like, you know, it's like
with you guys or with 72 total.
They make like 70 some movies total a year, and they are like, it is a completely different universe from the one that we were operating within at Fox. So it's a different world. But most of the things, honestly, as we're talking, most of the things that I love and most of the things that I'm now making as a more senior person are things that are like relationships that I like. My next movie that I'm making with A24 in March is a movie that I, again, as a CE, I went to a show at UCB and these guys wrote an original musical that was fucking insane. The funniest thing I had ever seen in my life, and no one knew who they were. They had never done anything before, but it was like, it was just magic in, you know, being there. And so
can you tell us their names?
Their name is Josh Sharp and Aaron Jackson, and they wrote a show called Fucking Identical Twins. And it's like it's a musical, and it's like a send up of like the Parent Trap if Lindsay Lohan was like an adult man, and like they're like, it's like in the tone, it's like Matt Stone and Trey, it's like very subversive and fucked up and insane, and about like the mother has like her vagina has fallen off at the Parthenon, and she's like 75 pushing 300. It's like just confusing and weird and all of those things. And I brought it to my boss when I was really junior, and I was like, we have to make this movie. And she was like, this is batshit crazy. You are out of your mind. You can never make this at Fox. And somehow I sent it to a junior executive that worked there that I loved, who kind of, we had a similar sensibility. And I said, this is the funniest thing I've ever seen in my life. You have to watch it. She watched it. I said, it's going to be really cheap. It's going to be a really cheap piece of development. Worst case scenario, you've invested in the next, you know, Matt Stone and Trey Parker. Worst case scenario, you've made a relationship with the next biggest talents in the world. And she bought it. And it was like a completely anomalous, bizarre situation. But we always knew it wasn't going to get made at Fox. You know, we knew that was like, we're going to use their money, we're going to get a script, and then we're going to go make it somewhere else that will actually make this movie and invest in it in the way that we want to. So there's always ways to generate material like that and to generate relationships like that.
Wait, and now you're making it with Turnin and A24?
Mm-hmm.
And just to, again, sorry, we are kind of digging into the minutiae of things, but I think a lot of our listeners, they hear A24 and they're like, oh, my favorite movies are A24. I just want to send them my script. But it sounds like to work with A24, you need first to have a developed script with a production company. And like, how does the relationship work between you guys and A24?
Yeah, I mean, it's a specific situation with us in the sense that I was working on this movie at Fox. They put it into turnaround because they were like, this is...
And sorry, just to clarify, because it put into turnaround means kind of like put on the rocks. Yeah.
They said like, thanks for playing. We're not making this movie, but you can have this script back. And should another studio want to make it, they will have to pay us back.
They owe us the development money. Yeah.
Yeah. So once that happened, we were looking for the next home for it. And we were always like trying to, every meeting that I took with independent studios, just to get to know people, I would always bring up this movie and say it was my favorite thing, and hoping that someone would share my sensibility at a certain point. And that's when, ultimately A24 came in because we met our executives there.
When you tell people about this movie, do you tell them how much it would cost to make or any talent that's attached or anything? Or you just say, I have a script and that's it?
I say I have the funniest script you will read in your entire life. And like, comedies right now suck. Studio comedies suck, and they're not funny anymore. And like, don't you want to be inspired and to make something really super funny?
Wouldn't it be great to make something so funny?
So funny. Like, don't you miss watching things that you really love that are so funny? So that was really, it's just that, you know. And like, you sometimes meet people who are like, what the fuck are you talking about? And sometimes you meet people who are like, get it, and are on your same page. And you're like, yeah, I'd love to make something so funny. So
divergence.
Basically, all of that to say, what I realized was I needed a piece of material that would have some IP value at Fox.
And this is, we're still talking about, this is the 1 hour of your day that you're devoting to Corey Entertainment.
Yes. And I would always go out to like NPR and look at all of the book reviews, because as I said, I didn't feel that anyone was going to like put something on my door that I would fall in love with. So I kept looking at those reviews always and pouring through them every night when I would get home and be in the me time. And I discovered that R.L. Stine was writing, there was an article that said R.L. Stine is writing new Fear Street books. And I had read them as a child and a teenager, and I was obsessed with those books. I loved those books.
And generally, once you read a book, if you go to Hudson News at the airport and you get something from the bestseller list, there's the odds that someone has already optioned this book are pretty high, right?
The odds that somebody optioned it before it was published are very high.
I remember when I first moved to LA, I read The Time Traveler's Wife, and I was like, this could be pretty good. And then it's like, Brad Pitt and Jennifer Aniston bought this like before it was written.
Yeah, you're like, bro, they're on the cover. They're on the cover of the copy you're reading.
Yeah, I was really nerdy. So like my strategy at that time was like, what material did I love as a kid? So like what had been optioned by producers back in the day, and then it didn't work, or it didn't have traction at that time, or people forgot about it, and then it became kind of stale in the or it had some like, sure.
Yeah, it has cachet, but people had forgotten.
And there are kind of like bubbles that come and go, right? There was the time when people were making, Hasbro was making like Battleship or whatever. Like,
I think that also, that has to do with the age of executives. Like when executives come of age and finally get to be like, hey, I'm going to make this movie, right? Like, just wait, guys. We're going to see like a Rugrats live action movie or something before you know it, you know?
Exactly. There's a really like actually beautiful nature to the thing where it's like executives, just like filmmakers, we're all a reaction to the people that we're coming up under, where we're saying, we don't want to do it like you did it. We want to do it differently.
Yeah. I have an awesome Rubik's Cube script, by the way.
It's just like you're attached to I think we all are chasing the things that we were attached to when we were kids, like somehow, in some way, in some fashion. So this book was close to my heart, and I was trying to find material that was picked over and lost that I could revive. And partially it was the thought that Goosebumps was in production. And so part of my thought process was, I can sell my bosses and I can sell Fox on the idea that should Goosebumps be a tremendous hit, we will have the next R.L. Stein thing coming up. So I thought, I both love this material. I love the movies that this reminds, like the films that this evokes for me, like in terms of like the era of horror that I grew up on, like Scream and Nightmare and Poltergeist and all those movies that we all love. So I thought I can both try and capture that feeling and that experience that I grew up on. And also there's a clear plan for how I can convince people that this makes sense. And so,
and sorry, another newbie question just to insert, is there like a website or somewhere you go to find out if a book has been optioned or if something has not worked?
Yes, there's a website called Write Center that is a, it's a like a paid subscription, and I didn't have a username, but if you like ask 20 people, one of them will have a password that you can use, or like you know, when you're an assistant, you have like tracking groups where you, it's a group of assistants that you can email and say like, do you like in search of something, in search of this script,
or like a Facebook password group or something like that. Yeah,
exactly. So that was, it was like Write Center. You can find out who controls the rights to things. So you would go, that's like the first stop to figure out whether there's something, it has an agent, you know, attached to it that is representing the material that you can call. In this case, R.L. Stein did not have, there was no like leads to get to him. Like it just was like, it was like,
he didn't have an agent. It wasn't.
He didn't have an agent. It was bought outright by like, you, if you do like a cursory Google search, it will tell, give you like a kind of brief history of where it had been, that it was like at Disney. It was bought outright by Disney in the 90s when they thought, when it was a big sort of smash hit book series. They had a plan to make a amusement park out of it, and to like, you know, create a R.L. Stein world and all of this stuff. And they spent,
you could
like
go
millions
to Fear Street.
Well, yeah, that's exactly.
That's really cool.
Millions of dollars on the rights. And then I think when the agenda changes at a studio, sometimes things just become not a part of their mandate. And so that this book series kind of fell into that category. And then as a result of that, it became nearly impossible to make a film out of it because they've spent so much money on it. And then that money sort of builds over time. So the longer that it stays there, the more money that it is against it or sort of accrues over time. And there was something like $3 million against the book series as a starting point. So
you have to spend $3 million just to get
just
started.
To get in the door. Yeah. Just to be like, well, you don't have to spend, you can create a deal structure in which it's like, we will pay you that $3 million should we go into production. But if you're a studio executive that is trying to protect their job and not a studio executive that is like, trying to create something awesome, you are looking at this piece of material and saying, okay, what is this? It's probably a horror movie. What is the budget of a horror movie right now? And then this was the time of Blum. So a horror movie budget at the time of Blum,
$6
million. There's $3 million once we go into production against this thing. This makes absolutely no sense. Like the second you, walk in the door, it's like it just makes no sense. So it requires like a tremendous amount of convincing and all of that stuff to try and get at the door. And I think because I was so junior and because I had so much like ambition and energy and passion for trying to make something of this thing, and it was the only thing I wanted to do, I like was just myopically focused on only this and trying to make it happen.
And did you like find the books and figure out what the movie would be and all that stuff?
Yeah. Wait, you're going to step on the punchline.
Oh,
buddy.
Sorry.
Yeah.
But there's hardly any punchline, but I like,
Well, Corey, how did you get the rights? What was the final straw?
The punchline. I tweeted at R.L. Stein because the people who had gotten Goosebumps also didn't know somehow how to reach him, which was weird. And then I noticed that he was very active on social media, so I tweeted at him being like, hey, I'm Corey, I work at Chernin. I love your books. I grew up on your books.
And he's not following you. You like it's this is a public tweet. You're like at R.L. Stein. Can I make these movies?
I don't. My Twitter has zero. It's just me.
And all you follow is R.L. Stein.
Yeah, like, hey, I'm this human being that you've never met. It's like, speaking of cold reach outs, it was sure. The coldest reach out you could possibly have. And oddly, he responded immediately.
Well, he probably Googled you real quick, right? You said, hey, I work at Sherman.
Maybe, but I was like, I wasn't even on, there was no like, there was no record of my existence probably at this point. Like, I don't think anyone, like, it was not even like.
Had you done Spies in Disguise by that point?
No, I hadn't done Spies in Disguise at that point. I had done absolutely zero things and reached out to him. And I think he was just probably like excited to hear from someone who was wanting to do something like that. And he said, it was so in the past. And he responded right away and said like, yeah, please reach out to my media manager, Yvonne. And I reached out to her and started a dialogue and then brought it into Fox. And they passed on it. And they were like, you guys are absolutely fucking insane. There's $5 million against it. And she and I kept in touch. And I just kept saying like to her, basically, you and me are in this together.
To Yvonne, his person.
Yeah. Hey, Yvonne, you and me are in this together. You please go to Paramount, go to Universal, go to all the different studios and take it in there and try and sell it. Because if you can get one bite, I will get this sold for you. I promise.
Wait, but so what is your role? Like, why does she need you at that point?
Basically, because we got on. Like, I think I had a really deep passion for the material and I was like very aggressive about trying to figure it out and how to make it happen. And so I essentially said to her, like, I am your key to making this happen. And I promise you, if you get an offer from another studio, I can convince my studio to make this happen.
You can leverage that offer and then you two can be working together. Yeah,
wait,
yeah.
Your studio being Fox.
My studio being Fox, I can leverage that offer and I can make sure that Fox will bite. And so we took it into, basically that happened. So Paramount became interested and then we leveraged that offer and then kind of pushed it. It gave me the momentum to be able to push my bosses, to push Fox, to push everyone to be like, hello, listen, it doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. It's competitive now. We'll figure out the rest later. Like, mm-hmm. Don't worry about all that money. We'll figure it out down the line.
It circles back to your bosses not wanting to look stupid. Corey's been saying, oh man, let's make Fear Street. Let's make Fear Street. Let's make Fear Street. There's no way they're going to let Paramount go make Fear Street.
Exactly. So you have to like, so anyway, you push that through under all circumstances. And then part of the...
And to be clear, there's no scripts at this point.
No, there's only books. And then part of this, my strategy in being like, okay, now I'm this junior executive. I have 200 books that are really expensive. It's my first project. I don't want to look stupid. How do I make this happen?
There's literally 200 of them.
200 books.
And you have the right to make any movie out of any book.
Correct. So we have the rights to the entire series of books. And so I started to think about how am I ever going to get this made now that I have it.
And was there never a TV show like where it's like each book is an episode?
Like it was developed in like a million different ways and things.
Yeah, it was called Are You Afraid of the Dark? And no one had to pay R.L. Stein for it. You know, like seriously, like it, you know, it's a horror anthology. So it's like, you know, you just make your own unless you really want to call it Fear Street.
Exactly. And I saw an opportunity. Like this was in the age of the beginning of the universe conversation. And mm-hmm. I saw...
And by universe, you mean Marvel Cinematic Universe, DC Universe, Universal Monsters even. Everyone was trying to like, you know, find the next giant franchise.
Space Jam yeah. Universe.
Yeah. Yeah. And like, I kind of was always, and I think it's what we're always all trying to do, is how do I marry my creative soul and ambition and desires with their business ambitions. You know, how do you like, how do you find a way to make those two things merge in a way? And that, so it becomes like, okay, I cringe at the idea of saying the word universe. It makes me want to die inside. Like it's my nightmare to say that word out loud. Some, for whatever reason, it just feels like I just hate it. So I was trying to think, okay, what's my version? How can I like keep my integrity and also pursue an idea like that? And what I started to get really excited about is, what's my version of that? Like, how do I create my version of that, that actually feels, or not actually feels, I mean, there's clearly like Marvel is king. So there's no, and like, what is my version where I can crush Marvel?
Sure. Yeah, yeah. But what makes sense for you, right? Yeah, yeah. I think
what can get me turned on about this that can make me like, that can sustain a process like this?
Right. I mean, the good thing and the terrible thing about universes, it's kind of the same. The problem is that like the only movies we're making right now are Marvel movies or whatever, right? But the cool thing is that means you get to make a spy movie and like a supernatural Doctor Who ripoff in the same year, right? So the gift of something like Fear Street is you get to dabble, right? You get to do what if someone said to you, hey, Corey, what if you got to make three radically different horror movies? You would be like, fuck yes, sign me up. What if they're all called Fear Street? Okay, sure, great.
That was exactly it. It was like, awesome. Like, we get to make three horror movies. Like, so it became this thought of, okay, I need to sell Fox on the idea of that this can be more than one film, because the budget of one film is the budget that is already against it. So how do I present
spend more money so you can make even more money, basically?
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. So it was that. And then we got into it.
Yeah. Yeah. Wild. Okay. So then, boy, I feel like we could talk to you for forever. I do want to talk a little bit about, correct me if I'm wrong, it's the same director for all three films, correct?
Yes.
Yeah. Lee Janiak. Janiak. Mm-hmm.
So how do you, but, and like we said, like, they're three drastically different styles, and there's, you know, things that kind of are unifying them, but like, it's three kind of different genre send-ups, right? And send-up isn't the right word, but styles. How do you find a single person who can do all three of those, and why do you think that they're the one to do it?
And why one director?
Sure. Yeah.
It's a great question. When we set out to make this project, the idea was, how do we tell stories different? How can we tell a story differently when we know where we're going before we begin? Like, what an awesome opportunity. If we're making a trilogy, how do we reinvent the narrative? And what we had, and what we had started with before Lee came onto the project, was we had had three scripts that were kind of more of a like repeatable formula, more of like a Final Destination or Nightmare, where it's like, okay, it comes back, or it comes back in a different way, or whatever it may be. But we had the eras set, and we were trying to crack how to marry them all together, like how to create a mystery that is drawing you through all the films. And so it became like a very like extensive process of meeting like every single director in town to see who might have a sensibility that is similar to ours, that might have the brain and the ambition to sign on to a project like that. And it's a really hard thing, because you want to make the movies as soon as possible. It was necessary. There are very few directors that are working within the studio system that don't have development already set up that they're about to direct.
And what do you mean by working within the studio system?
Like people who are already kind of baked into development, like directors that are already attached to projects that are set up at studios.
But do you need... like, do you need that type of director?
No, and Lee was not that type of director.
Mm-hmm. But that's the devil, you know, right? Like, so when you're, it's like, okay, well, someone else has vetted this person, so we know that they can handle millions and millions of dollars. And, you know, if it's a failure, it's like, boy, well, Paramount thought that they could do it too, so you can't blame me for hiring them. you know?
Yeah, definitely. And there's also a thing where it's three movies and no one had ever greenlit three movies at once before that had net. There was no guarantee that there was any way that that would work. So you had to give a studio a certain level of confidence that we were going to pull that off.
And was Netflix involved at this point?
No, it was still Fox at that point. So it became a process of meeting everyone. And so at first you're meeting everyone that, you know, the studio likes just as a like early exploration. And then very quickly you're like, who has a vision? Who's awesome? Like, because it's like, you're going to make three movies. Mm-hmm. It's got to be awesome. Like, you can't not be awesome. You can't not have a really cool person trying to helm it. And I always felt there was like, you wanted them to be kind of indie feeling, because I felt like horror movies just felt so, I felt like it felt so studio and right,
there's some
annoying.
Grit to them.
Yeah. Yeah, all of the movies that you're referencing, studios didn't make.
They were all R-rated, and they were all kind of like subversive and fucked up, but also teen movies, and those things like kind of don't go together within in a way, because when you're in the studio system and there is a theatrical release, they're thinking about things like if this is meant for a 16-year-old, how is a 16-year-old going to buy a ticket if it's an R-rated movie? Like right. It's that kind of thing.
Yeah,
but it was really important to me that it was that way. And so anyway, I met Lee, and she was someone who I had met through Adam Wingard, who was actually the director that I began this process with. And she came in to talk to us about being a part of the first iteration of it. And she was so opinionated and awesome and brilliant that it literally almost was like, oh, you can't, like, this needs to be yours or not at all. Like, this needs to be yours. And then the second we parted, it immediately occurred to me that like she was the one, and like, because she was like, she just got it. Like we sent her the first movie and the second movie, and she called me immediately and she was like, I'm in love. I need to do this. And she created a 70-page lookbook that was like the most in-depth thing. And it's like,
it had 50 images per page.
Literally, it was like insane. It was like a VHS tape, like crazy, like beautiful thing that she put together that outlined how she would, you know, think about the music, how she would think about the filmmaking approach, like how she would approach, and all of that sustained through the entire process. Like it was okay, 94, I want to make it classically shot. It should feel like a, you know, Scream. Or
if you rewatch Scream, you're like, oh my god, like everything looks incredible. It's like Steadicam, anamorphic. Everything is like perfectly sharp. It's great.
It's excellent. So she was like, I want it this way. And then in the 70s film, I want the filmmaking to be more 70s and closer, a closer point of view. And I want to keep getting closer and closer to the center of the story. I want to like take the filmmaking first, make it very objective and very omniscient point of view, and then keep getting closer and closer to the to our protagonist of the story until that's the only thing you're following.
And she didn't have the job at this point.
No.
She just went and made this on her own.
The thing I love, I feel like we've heard stories about great lookbooks and, you know, great, like awesome materials. And that feels kind of apparent to people who I think are paying attention. What the thing that I love that you said that is the most noteworthy is you called the first thing you described her as is opinionated, and that you know, that's another way of saying point of view. But I think that sometimes it would be easy to be like, oh my god, this is a job that would change my life, it's my dream job.
Say what you want to hear. I never want someone to say what I want to hear. I want someone to challenge me. I always want to know that we're making the same film. Like that's the most important thing, is to know that, like, From day one, I'm sure you've heard this from most of the people that you talk to, but it's the most important thing to know. From day one, we are the objective is the same. Like we are trying to make the same movies, and we both know what we're trying to make.
But you want that while also them having a strong point of view.
Someone to take all of my notes. I hate that. It's like you don't want someone to take all. If you're telling them how to write their thing, it's awful. Like you want someone to be like, I love that note. I love this note. And then, okay, that note, I know how to make it my own. You know, I know how to make this one. Like you're saying something, I hear you, but I don't totally agree, but I know how to kind of fix it. Fix the thing that I think you're saying that, but it's not exactly how you're saying it. So it's like, it's your vision. Like it's your vision as a director, and you want to know that someone has that clarity and that point of view and that strength to fight the whole way through. And it's a delicate balancing act because it's politic at some time. Sometimes it's politic with studios. Sometimes it's politic with producers. But
and I see she has a writing credit. Also, was that part of your search? Someone that can write and direct?
It was important to me that whoever the director was had a deep sense of story. So it was less that they needed to be a director necessarily, I mean, a writer necessarily, but more so that they were really strong developers and really strong storytellers. And they had a really good sense of character development was really important in the search. And totally brilliant. She was just a totally brilliant human being and really singular. And she came in and kind of blew me away in that way. And she also is just a badass. Like she she had a movie at the time that was at Sony, and they wanted to green light it, but it would have been like in development for years. And like the second we started engaging with her, they were like, oh, you're greenlit. And she was like, what the fuck? She's like, I've been trying to make this movie with you guys for like 6 years. What are you talking about? Like, you never wanted to make this movie. Now that I'm like the cool girl at the ball, you want to make this movie? Yeah. And she literally was like, fuck all y'all. I'm going to make these movies. And like, it was like a really long process of trying to untangle that and figure out how to get her out of there. But she really stood up for what she believed in and really like was just like, I need to be in love. I'm in love. And I can't ignore that.
Corey, I feel like the two takeaways from this conversation are like, go hard, right? Like be unstoppable. And then also Hollywood is terrible is what you're reminding us.
You know, it's like, I think it's like, there's like two things. There's like, there are great people and there are awful people. That's just the reality of it.
Yeah. Which is true everywhere. Do you know what I mean? I think we just kind of, most people don't talk about their jobs in quite the same level of detail. You know, there aren't many podcasts about like how my mom, you know, hated certain teachers she had to teach with or whatever. That'd be a good one though.
Yeah, I'm like, everyone sucks. But no, I don't think everyone sucks. I like it's there's so much possibility. It's just but it's passion based. Like if you have passion and you have a vision and you make sure that like as a filmmaker, I think you want to display a level of I need to make this. And then if you have that level of commitment, it will happen eventually. It has to.
Yeah, that's awesome. So controversial question, which is your favorite part? Which Fear Street?
I love 78. 78 is my favorite.
Nice. And they're all out right now, right? People can see them?
People can see them on Netflix. They're all out.
Should they watch them in order or does it matter?
They have to. They have to watch them in order.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
It's a trilogy.
They all connect. It takes you backwards in time to solve a mystery. So it's a more, you can watch them individually, but it's a much more much more complete and fulfilling process if you watch them in order.
Oh, that's cool. Okay, I didn't realize. I will watch them in order, I guess. I was gonna watch part two first, but I guess I'll start.
Yeah, I was gonna go historically actually. Very confusing.
So your next movie, or how can we find out like what you're doing next? Are you still not tweeting?
I'm not tweeting. Still not tweeting. I'm making this A24 musical in January.
And what's the title?
It's called Fucking Identical Twins.
And is that going to be the theatrical name?
Certainly hope so.
I mean, A24, they might go for it, right?
No, but what there is no movie, I mean, there's Kevin Can F Himself, right?
And End of the Effing World, right? Like, I think at this point you're allowed to do
it. Yeah, I just want to just put stars everywhere. Yeah. Like, in their names, like Josh, star.
Yeah, that's really funny.
Just really play on it forever. Yeah. But thank you guys for taking the time to talk to me.
Yeah, of course. Do you have a minute to hang out and endorse with us? Our unpaid endorsements?
Unpaid endorsements.
So my unpaid endorsement, inspired by this conversation, made me think of one of my favorite horror movies that I feel like people don't talk about enough, and it's a film called The Descent. Have you guys seen The Descent?
Yeah.
Neil Marshall.
That's like the underground
movie,
right?
It is the best, and I saw it under the best circumstances you could possibly have. It was the Ford Amphitheater. LA Film Festival used to have a screening series there where they would just do, like, every Saturday night they'd have whatever the biggest movie of that week was, and so we would just get season passes. I didn't know a thing about the film, and so, like, it's a bit of a spoiler to say that there were creatures involved, but you don't know that for a long time. It's about 30 minutes before you see your first monster of any sort, and so it was, and I don't think most of the audience didn't know what they were in for either. So it's just kind of like this kind of tense cinematic spelunking movie for a long time. It is legitimately great. And certainly in my top 10 favorite horror movies of all time. So The Descent is my unpaid endorsement. Corey, what you got?
Okay, my unpaid endorsement is BoJack Horseman. I love this show so much. Just the best. Just the most unexpected tone for a animated show. And you would think it would be super inside baseball about Hollywood, but it really is just like a meditation on depression, which is a completely odd way to come into an animated show. And it's like some of the best character development I've ever seen on a television show somehow, which is
with a talking horse.
Odd, with a talking horse head. So huge endorsement, huge to watch.
Awesome.
I'm going to burn two good ones. I think Matt, he like keeps a running list of endorsements and then he'll just pick one off. But I'm just like, if I have good ones, I love to give them out. So one is this, and I bet a lot of people know about both of these, but the New York Times has this Anatomy of a Song series. Have you guys ever seen that?
Is it like Song Exploder? Good.
It's kind of like Song Exploder, but this guy, his name is like Joe something. He will just get on a Zoom call or like a FaceTime or something with an artist. Like, I watched Lord today and he's done. He has like Tones. Do you know her? She has that song, Dance Monkey. Dance Monkey, Dance Monkey, Dance Monkey. Whoa, whoa, whoa. You know that song? She's like Australian. But, you know, she had Taylor Swift. Like all these kind of huge artists. But he just interviews them, and then sometimes they'll bring on a producer. It's just like Song Exploder. They talk about where the song came from and how they came up with it, and they'll show pieces of the music video, and they talk a lot about how they've grown as an artist. Like Lord talked about Royals, you know, her first song she wrote when she was 15, and now she's 24 or something. So it's just a totally different, comes from a different point of view, and I just really love it. They're like 10 minute episodes, and they're, I watch them on the New York Times app, but I think you can watch them on YouTube. And my other endorsement is a book, and I thought of it because we were talking to you about books. It's called Project Hail Mary. It's like one of these books that was for sure optioned before it came out. It's from this guy, Andy Weir, who wrote The Martian. And the reason I even know about it is because this guy I'm a fan of that, Matt, you might know him personally, Ren. He's like part of Corridor Digital.
Yeah, I don't know him personally, but I am familiar. Yeah.
His Twitter handle is Sir Render. His name is like WREN, like the bird. But he also is into 3D graphics. So his Twitter handle is Sir Render, which I guess also is a word. But he tweeted, he said, I'm so jealous of whatever filmmaker gets to make this movie because there's all these like amazing parts to it. So I was at an airport and I hunted it down and I found it, and I paid like $32 because I only had the hardcover, and it's so big. It took up like half my suitcase, but it's a really awesome book. It's about this guy that wakes up on a spaceship and is trying to figure out why he's there and what his goal is. And it's written really well. If you're into science fiction and mysteries and sci-fi, which I guess is the same thing as science fiction, then you'll really love it. It's called Project Hail Mary. So that's it.
Well, Corey, thanks so much. Well, as we said, you're not super into Twitter. Is there anything, any way that people can keep track of the things that you're making, or just go to the movies, read Deadline, and you're good to go? Yeah,
just set an alert on Deadline.
Alert on Deadline, and hope I'm on it one day.
So if you want to learn more about the things that we talked about on the show, you can go to justshootitpod.com. You can email us at justshootitpod@gmail.com if you have questions or concerns, or if you just want to say hello. And you can tweet at us across all social media at justshootitpod. I'm at Mr. Matt Enlow.
And I'm on Instagram. I'm at O Kaplan. On Twitter, I'm at Smitey Pyleg. This episode was edited by Sarah Weirda. Our social media manager, or maybe one last time, is Derek Aiello. And the music you're listening to is from the Free Music Archive and the artist Jazar. And thanks, Corey. We will see you all.
Thanks,
next time.
Corey.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.